Sorry, I sort of petered out
No, not at all. I mean, and with the wonders of editing, no one will ever know.
there.
It'll seem like I straight in there. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Ben Ebden.
Hi.
And we're going to explore the opportunity to change careers and become a teacher. But first, Ben, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
So I have to admit, I'm a complete geek. So over the summer, I've been a bit busy. So I've tried to narrow it down. I know the rule is you're only meant to have one, but I've got sorts of two honourable mentions I wanted to sneak in just because they suit me so much. The first was Mr. T Does Primary History, which I found really, really helpful. It really helped me think about how I'm planning history units and how to get most of them. The second one was The Writing Book by Zoe and Timothy Paramore, which is around particularly actually really good for Key Stage 2 writing. It's really looking at how we're encouraging children to write in a different way, and I found it extremely helpful. But the one I wanted to focus on is only it's only a small book, but I think I've got so much from it. It's Sarah Cottingham's Azabelle's Meaningful Learning in Action, which for me is one of those books I read once and I just had to keep rereading it. I think I've probably read it about three different times now because there's so much packed into it. And for me, it was there's so much around, you know, retrieval, around the individual meaning that children get from lessons and why it can be so different, so much around prior knowledge. I actually read it, and then the following week, I read Graham Nuttall's Hidden Lives of Learners. And if you read Graham Nuttall's book, so it makes so much sense in the context of what Sarah tells you about Azabelle's theories and how she's presented them in such a helpful way.
Fantastic. I mean, I've read two of the three, and I probably should read the writing book. But I've seen you asking questions about spelling and the teaching of writing on Twitter. And so you've only really trying to get to the bottom of quite a deep rabbit hole. I'm right in thinking.
Yeah, I've also been. I mean, two of the ones I didn't bring up actually were Lynn Stone's Spelling for Life and Reading for Life, which I found incredibly helpful as well. Yeah, I'm really trying to get to the bottom of how best to help children, how to be much more explicit with our instruction around how we help children write and how we help them to spell. Because I think, especially in the classes I've had, a lot of cognitive load has been spent on worrying about spelling, and people lose track of what they were trying to do in the writing. And I think there's lots of different blocks you can put in place through a much more direct instruction rather than just getting people to write more, which I think traditionally is what we've done. And it's about really focusing on those skills that make it easier for the children. It is a rabbit hole. It's a complete rabbit hole. And every time I think I've got somewhere, I then realize I've maybe gone back two steps. I've been hitting up Chris Such quite a lot as well for advice on it as well, and he's been super helpful because there's so many different strands that you have to pull together. It's such a difficult concept or a difficult thing to get your head around and to help people as best you can, really.
Nice, yeah. I mean, Chris is great for that. He'll spend hours chatting with people on social media, trying to share his advice with them and stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yeah, Kieran, what are you reading for?
So I've actually been listening this week, and it's the Ancients podcast, and it's about an episode about ancient Vietnam. And I know that we don't necessarily teach ancient Vietnam, but if you take a step back while listening and analyze sort of the metadata, like, for instance, they explore the reasons why nations choose the focal point of their history. So for instance, Vietnam has they have gone back beyond the Han invasion of the part of the world they're in now. And so it talks about, you know, the reasons for civilizations, the decisions they make, and also how we can ascertain different things about civilizations without a really detailed archaeological record. And so, although the subject matter, you know, I think is really interesting anyway, on a meta level, you've got this opportunity to analyze some of the big themes that you might be teaching in your history lessons. And so I always find that really interesting. So while we're checking out, it's about 60 minutes and it's all very, very good.
That's really interesting. I always wonder in, 200 years time, providing we've still got a planet to live on, if people look back, let's say at British history, I wonder which, if they're completely impartial, if you can be, what are the key elements that people would draw out over the last 300 or 400 years? It'd be really, really interesting to see.
Yeah, massively. I always think about what happens if, all the technology goes wrong and you've only got the most ridiculous examples of, because modern life in some ways can be really, really ridiculous. And if the archaeological record were YouTube videos that
might represent a cat.
So they must have worshipped this cat god on the keyboard. We've spoken before about Test and
Hansa. We have.
Fantastic episode with Christian Still. But we've been talking recently about how you've made the shift to teaching after a career, to my knowledge, in the City of London. And so it'd be really interesting to see, obviously unpick through your reasons for that and your experience so far, because I know that you'll recommend making the shift to teachers, and I think it'd be really helpful to sort of explore that. So I think it makes sense to start at the beginning. What did you do before you were a teacher?
So I was in the city for about 25 years, maybe slightly over, showing my age now. And the lion's share of that time I spent in Magic Circle law firms. I'm not a lawyer, but I was responsible for the business development and marketing functions in some of those law firms, particularly around the technology they were using with their clients. So it was how we could use technology to really get the clients linked into us, get our claws into them so that they used us as a law firm and not our competitors who are literally down the road. And that was really interesting. And I did that for well over 10 years. I then swapped sides. I went from gamekeeper to hunter, and went into a few roles where I was actually using my knowledge and relationships within those law firms to sell into them. And most recently, that was artificial intelligence tools that would be used, that are used in some of the bigger litigations where you're going through literally millions and millions of documents and you're trying to find evidence that you might have to disclose, or smoking guns on the other side of things that could be really, really important in the case, which manually you're not going to have the time or the resources to be able to go through. But with artificial intelligence going the way it is, it's much easier for a technology tool to do that. And again, it was very, very interesting. But at the end of the day, I think it was soulless. And lockdown happened. And like everyone else who's middle-aged, I think I spent a lot of time reflecting on life generally. I decided at that point to go down to 3 days a week to focus more on childcare as well, trying to educate my daughter because the school couldn't put in place much. It did a fantastic job of keeping everyone safe in the situation it was in, but it couldn't offer much in the way of teaching. After long, long conversations with my wife, and she supported me completely, I decided, I just couldn't go on doing something which was essentially making people, rich people, even richer. And I wanted to do something that I felt had some value to it, some social value. Teaching was the avenue I was most keen on and explored. And it's something I'd thought about doing after school anyway, but I sort of fell into the roles in the city not a clue of what I was doing, but it certainly wasn't premeditated. It was just taking opportunities as they presented themselves. So then, made the proactive decision to go into teaching, and then studied at a SCIT, also doing a PGC at the same time. Yeah, then the rest is history, I suppose. I've now been qualified for only a year. It feels like longer. Sometimes it doesn't feel like longer. Because I think, Yeah, I mean, the skit is a great way of getting into teaching, I think, because you're in schools from day one. I was actually in a year one class with 35-year-olds running at me before I'd even done a single session with the skit. So it really was a baptism of fire, but your hand is held quite nicely as you progress. It's not sort of overload. You're not expected to be able to plan lessons from day one. It is very much a gradual process. And I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. So I haven't regretted a single day.
Fantastic. I mean, I've only really got two experiences of the working world. I've got the sort of part-time jobs you do when you're studying, so working in various supermarket chains, and then being a teacher, which, as you sort of alluded to, has this moral purpose and this drive behind it. What's it like as an adult in a job where, like, as you say, soulless, I think was the word used to describe it. Are you aware of that the whole time, or does it come to you one day that you think, there must be more purpose in what I do?
I think for me, it grew on me like fungus, but I was always aware of it. As I said earlier, it wasn't a premeditated move to go into that career. It's something that I took opportunities as they presented themselves, and the role kept growing. But always at the back of my mind, there was a feeling that I should be doing something more. And in fact, I did spend time coaching rugby for primary age children. I spent 8 years as a governor at a local primary school before I had a child. So, way before I had a child, it was always something I was passionate about and interested in. But I couldn't see a way of, I didn't. I think I got seduced by the money essentially, and wasn't willing to let it go. And I think you get to a point in your life, and I think a lot of teachers will probably hate me for this, who have, chosen the moral path throughout their life. But it gets got to the point for me where I thought, no, I just can't. I can't do this anymore. I have to listen to that voice inside me saying, change, do something worthwhile instead.
I mean, I don't think anyone's going to be casting judgment, them, because obviously not everybody can be a teacher at the same time and stuff like, so I think, yeah, it's, I don't know how to describe it, but I wouldn't worry about that. But as far as I can see, you've been working tirelessly to acclimatize to the role. What have been the real positives from your first 12 months as a teacher?
I mean, I have loved every single day. I mean, some days have been hard. Some days have been really hard. Some days have been even harder. But there isn't one single day where I couldn't look back and point to something that has been absolutely fantastic and really made my day. For me, I get a bit annoyed with myself that I didn't go into teaching earlier because, I just absolutely love being in the classroom. I love working with the children. And for me, the biggest positive is seeing children who have struggled or who are struggling, but working with them, showing them that you believe in them, and seeing results at the end of the year, or at the end of the term, but the end of the year particularly, where they have, taken you on face value when you've said, work with me, and I'll really work with you on this. And they've done it, and they've come out the other side with fantastic progress. And that's, at the end of the day, I think what makes it so rewarding. But that's not it. There's also all of the micro interactions you have during the course of the day when people come to you because they're concerned about something or worried about something that else that's happening in their lives. And all of those opportunities to be able to help people just make it a fantastic life. It does mean it's, the responsibility on you is huge. And I know I spend probably more time than I should with my nose buried in books and going to conferences and things like that. But the way I look at it is I have a responsibility during the day for those 30 children, at least 30 children, because you're planning sometimes for, well, half the time for, because we're two club form entry for next door as well. And I'm aware of how much I don't know, if you see what I mean. It would be fine if I didn't know what I didn't know, but I'm aware of what I don't know. And it's almost like there's a rush that I have to want to be the best I can for them. And that does cause me to put a lot of pressure on myself to read as much as I can, to try and put things in place as quickly as I can. for those 30 individuals essentially.
Yeah, I know that sensation. You know, sometimes you can't stop. You know, you want to finish that on the same day. You know, and even if it means you're reading through three different points in the day. I sometimes wished I had done something different as an adult before I went in, because my NQT year, I was learning how to be a grown up at work, and so I didn't take notes, and I thought I'd remember everything in meetings. You know, I've talked about this before in the podcast. There were certain things, you know, ways of being that I wasn't aware of. Do you think that's helped you?
I would say absolutely it has, because there's so much you learn about, life in general, I think, when you're 18, when you finish your degree. You know, I wasn't a mature person at the age of 21. I can tell you that. I was still interested in, parties and the high life. And I think a lot of that, I suppose, maturing happens between 21 and 25, maybe even later. I don't think I'm the final package yet still. But you're right. There's so much you learn about how the world functions, how you have to be in a job. But I think there's more than that as well. I think there's lots of other things that have been helpful for me in my previous lives as well. So, for example, I would be giving presentations normally to 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, up to 200 or 300 partners every week, maybe even two or three times a day. Not 300 free times a day, but there'll be groups of 20 or 30 free times a day. And it's actually a bit like a classroom, because what you're doing is you're trying to put yourselves, you're looking at their micro reactions of how they're whether they're paying attention to you, what their faces are doing. You're trying to scrutinize them at all points. And that's actually very similar to what I'm doing in the classroom, is I'm looking around, trying to put myself in the shoes of the class. What are they taking in? What aren't they? You know, so that there is on one hand, there's that sort of the growing up, which is, I think, really, really valuable. But on the other hand as well, there are experiences that you can get outside teaching, which can really, I think, prime you. Certainly doesn't get you the whole way there, don't get me wrong, by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly gave me a head start over people that didn't have experiences like that.
I think particularly public speaking and things like that, there most teachers will say to you, they're still not too keen on the room full of 100 adults. My wife has been delivering more CPD recently than she has for a while. And she's like, how do you do this all the time? And I think it's something that's practice, isn't it?
I think it's practice, but I also think it's content knowledge or domain specific expertise. If I'm talking to people about something that I know really, really well, then I'm very, very comfortable. If there are people in the room that I know a lot more than me about a particular subject, then that will certainly set my nerves going.
Yes, it's their micro reactions that you're looking at
most. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had people walk into rooms and my stomach has just dropped. I'm like, oh no, better make this good. What have been the biggest challenges for you over the last 12 months or even part of your training?
I mean, it's very, there's a number of them, I think. The first one I would say is, the ITT that I had was great. The training I had was great. But that doesn't mean that when you arrive in the classroom on day one, that you know what you're doing, in words of one syllable. There is so much more that you have to learn. I think ITT is essentially step one. And I think the government, has recognized that with the 2-year ECT course. But I mean, I would very much doubt that anyone could be the finished product after 2 years on of just being an ECT. There's just so much out there. And I think for me, one of the challenges is slowing myself down. It's not getting myself too, realizing that it's going to take time to get there, realizing that I can't be there tomorrow, realizing that, there's going to be stuff that I'm still learning in 5 years' time. And no matter how much work I put in, okay, it will improve me, but there'll still be more improvements that I want to make. I think that is challenging. Whereas in the city, in the corporate world, it's very easy to see your success and where you are, and you can feel, I'm comfortable at this place. Whereas with teaching, I think because of the responsibility of those 30 people in the room, there's so much I want to do so quickly, and it doesn't work. You can't do that much so quickly. You have to, you know, what I found is I have to really narrow down my focus and put things in place and learn from them, and refine them and refine them and refine them before I get brilliant results or better results from them. So that's number one, is not being the finished article by any means when you finish training. I think another challenge for me is going in. I haven't found it as difficult as I thought I would, but from being in a relatively senior role, going in right at the bottom. But actually, in some ways, I've quite enjoyed that, grabbing coffee for people or doing photocopying for people. And, you know, it's been kind of nice, actually, to be at the bottom of the pile, if you like. But also, I've been incredibly lucky with the schools I've been in, I think, which have said to you, you know, if you're ready for the responsibility, we'll give it to you. You know, they won't artificially hold you back. So I can only be really, really grateful, particularly to the school I'm in, for the way that they sort of view progress and the way they will give you feedback you can learn from, but the way they will also give you responsibilities if they think you're ready for them.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. You never feel like you know everything, or you've done everything, or you've honed everything, you know. And I think the minute you do that, it's almost that's when you sort of start to slip. Certainly I've had points in my career where I thought I've got things cracked, and then very quickly realized, no, I've just been complacent and stuff. So yeah, that can be quite, it's interesting that, you know, it's your internal pressure that you've mentioned as most challenging. Has there been anything from the outside? I don't know. I mean, the one that comes to mind is that you've come from this profession where you've got the canon, you've got these habits and sort of ways of being, and then teaching's a bit more free flow. And obviously there's discussion about how best to teach and how best to engage with the craft. Has that been a challenge, or has that just been something that you've just sort of adapted to?
No, that is a challenge, because I suppose the environment I came from, we had very clear ideas and game plays, if you like, or playbook about exactly what would work and how to go about it, and we executed it. And obviously in teaching that isn't the case, because there are so many different variables with those 30 individuals in the room. But I suppose I wasn't necessarily expecting to see such a distinction between different schools of thought about how best to teach children. So, for example, let me explain what I mean by that, because it's probably a bit opaque. When I first started the course, we had our first university lecture, and they said, you know, these are the different theories of learning. You will probably find that you will align with one of these. And, you know, at the back of my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm a social constructivist. This sounds brilliant. This is what I'm, this is me. Yeah. And then you meet the reality of the classroom, and you realize that actually what they're telling me doesn't work particularly well. It might be a theory of knowledge, but actually if you look slightly more deeply into it, it's not a theory of learning. And I wasn't expecting there to be such a divide, you know, like I suppose if you like the trads and the reformers, I can't remember what are the two sides called.
Oh, the progs, the trads and the progs.
Trads and the progs, yeah. I wasn't expecting there to be such a sort of gulf between the two theories, I suppose. I assumed, perhaps naively, that, you know, that those arguments would have been put to bed, I suppose. And I think in some ways they have, but we still see, I'm doing a scheme of work at the moment. Obviously I won't name the provider, but it's actually in history. And if we accepted the scheme as was, then the first lesson would be looking at just portraits of Henry VIII and what they told us about bias. The second lesson would be a murder investigation into one of his wives, where there'll be police tape everywhere and things like this, without any focus whatsoever on what actually happened in that time period and why that time period's important. So I wasn't expecting that sort of fluffy stuff to be still so prominent, I suppose. Even though, as I said, when I first started in that first lecture, I thought, yeah, that sounds like me. I want to be one of those progressive people. I'm a progressive person, I thought to myself. But then in the reality of the classroom, you start to realize that I suppose people think with knowledge, and without that knowledge, they can't really think. Having a conversation about why people might have presented Henry VIII in different ways in two different portraits of him without knowing what happened in his reign and why people might have held those opinions about him is absolutely pointless. So that was a surprise to me, I think, and still is a surprise to me that we still see that. And maybe I'm being a bit too hard on that particular scheme, or being a bit too hard on that way of learning, but for me, I don't get it.
I mean, yeah, I find that fascinating because, again, I've only ever known a world in which everything was up for debate. And yeah, I'd quite like to, you know, like quite like to, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, but like practice medicine, practice law, and see what that consistency of approach is like and stuff. And would you say that it's the only surprise, or have there been any other surprises?
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, I suppose one of the other surprises is just how hard it is to teach well. I mean, I go and see more experienced teachers at my school, and you know, they knock you off your feet, because they probably wouldn't have done if I was just observing without the limited knowledge that I've got already. But having built up a bit of knowledge over the last couple of years, you can appreciate what they're doing, the way they're finding out what people's prior knowledge is. They're working on the misconceptions. They've already got really good ideas of what some of those misconceptions are, and that surprised me, is just how hard work that is. You know, when you go to school yourself, you don't have an understanding of actually what's going on. We all think we're experts about education because we all went to school, but obviously we're not, because what the teacher is doing is actually far more complex and far more sophisticated than that. So yeah, just how hard it is to get 30 people working out what their prior knowledge is, what their misconceptions are, how you're going to extend their learning, how you're going to make sure that learning sticks. That really surprised me, I think, and you know, continues to surprise me. Is and when you watch someone who's a master at it, I think I've watched masters from my day one in training, but as I said, I didn't really appreciate what I was watching there. But the more you know, the more, and then you watch some of, when I watch some of my colleagues, I just think, wow, you know. One day, maybe Ben, you'll be there. Yeah, but it's something to aim for. I suppose one of the other things that surprised me, it's a bit about the first one as well, is just how much misinformation is out there as well. So I not nothing to do with my school, but I went to a training session with the borough. It was actually a PE training session, but people were still, you know, the trainers were still talking us through kinesthetic learners and auditory learners and things like that, and you're thinking, you know, there's got to be some sort of way of getting sort of common knowledge or knowledge that's been agreed for at least the last decade out, so everybody is aware of it. But of course, I mean, how do you do that? That's another question entirely.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned the early career framework in England. I mean, it seems to prioritize certain sources over others, and perhaps that's their sort of vehicle for ensuring that people who join the profession are equipped with some of the things that we, I think, believe to be reasonably robustly, I don't know if I want to say evidenced, but robustly researched. And
yeah,
and even if that matches up with a particular ideology, it's, I think, still a better starting point than that deficit you start, you know, where you thinking that you have to change your instruction for the preferences of the pupils in your class. Because if you change it 30 ways, you are you're going to be there all day.
You're going to confuse everybody. Yeah, absolutely. And I think to an extent, we're seeing more of that now with teaching, which is really focusing on those who maybe struggle with concepts the first time around, who have sometimes been called children with SEN, or you know, or the bottom 20%. We're seeing that actually the focus that's going on to make sure that the teaching is accessible for those children, as it should be, is actually having a broader benefit as well, because what works well there seems to work for most children as well. When I went to school, I went in the period where, you know, grammar wasn't prioritized and spelling wasn't prioritized. And as a result, I mean, I think I've had to really play catch up with some of my colleagues who have, you know, who went to school more recently and who were probably taught a bit better. It's definitely been something that I've had to catch up with.
How recently did they go to school? That's the case. I mean, I suppose, yeah, whenever the phonic check, man, what age of those children are they working yet? I'm trying to think, probably not.
Oh, no, probably not the phonics ones. But I lived in a sort of wild west of grammar. I mean, we were never taught about clauses or you know, an independent clause was news to me. I just, you know, it's something I had managed to learn through osmosis, but not everyone can learn that through osmosis. And it's just unfair, isn't it, that, you know, people aren't explicitly taught it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the prevalence of the comma splice suggests that lots of people are in the same boat. Because
And the comma splice was news to me. I mean, I looked and I thought, I've been doing that for years. I better back my ideas up.
Yeah, I mean, punctuation for me is just a way of expressing myself. So I'll fire it in wherever I want it. You know, if it feels right to me, and then ask Chris to proofread it for me.
I mean,
masters at work. I mean, I think that's a really good analogy because, you know, you could look at the Mona Lisa and you could say, oh, that's a fairly nice painting of a fairly nice woman. But really, it's the story behind it, isn't it? And the knowledge you bring to it that allows people. I mean, I don't think I have the knowledge to appreciate that particular painting in the way that many people could. But there are certain paintings that I know quite a lot about. And so I can see that, you know, you don't know what you're looking at. Well, it's just aesthetically pleasing, but you can really properly analyze it with that background knowledge, can't you?
That does. I mean, that's an ongoing process because every time you observe something, you're learning something new as well, or you're learning a new way of doing something. And it's incredible how people can, how it appears second nature to some of my colleagues. You know, it's fantastic to watch.
Yeah, I think we're really starting, you know, I don't know about recently, but certainly the conversation seems to discuss more about how we make those behaviors sort of tacit. I don't know. Certainly, I think knowledge can be tacit. I don't know if behaviors can be tacit, but they're, you know, automatizing these routines and the conversation around habits and sort of, you know, joining routines and things together. I think I certainly feel like we understand and we have a shared dialogue about how we can improve as teachers. I mean, at Research Ed Deutschland the weekend, Stuart Keim from the great, you know, evidence-based education, and they have their great teaching toolkit. And he did a really, really enjoyable and informative talk about starting off with, you know, perceptions of education and great teaching, and then perhaps what we might want to do. And you know, a lot of parallels in what you're saying, I think. And he was almost saying, choose one of these things to get better at this year, and then bit by bit, you improve as a teacher.
Yeah, because the temptation is just to try and do too much, and then you get nowhere fast. And that is something that I'm always arguing with myself about. Or how about if it's just subject knowledge and something in teaching at the same, you know, it doesn't amp up. You do find ways of adding more things to your list of things you want to improve in. But it is a question about prioritizing it, which is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the last person to give advice on that because I'm hopeless, you know, because, you know, managed to make my job my hobby at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, not one for the
world. Well, I do. I mean, I can sympathize with what you're saying because I just find it absolutely fascinating. You know, what we know now about how children or how anyone learns and how we can get better results. But yeah, and I get fascinated about learning more and more about it. So, you know, I think nothing about going on holiday and taking 4 or 5 books with me that I really, really enjoy. It's not painful to read these. It's pleasurable to read these. But whether or not that gives me enough downtime, I don't know, because I'm getting pleasure from it. I'm not finding it a chore to do. So I'm hoping that come September, I won't be sort of absolutely exhausted.
Yeah, that is a tough one. I mean, we're almost going down the path of group therapy, but I had to sometimes to relax. I'm like, no, you've worked enough. You deserved, it's 10 o'clock at night. Let's just switch off for a bit. Yes. There are different ways that people can change careers. I mean, there's certainly many more routes into teaching than I remember when I started. And there are even some companies have been set up specifically to help people transition from one to the other. What advice would you give to anyone considering becoming a teacher, having already worked in some other field or profession?
One thing I couldn't do, but I think I would suggest that everyone does it, is they, before they make their final decision, is they spend more, a few days in a row in a school, if they can, shadowing a teacher. So they actually have a real view, have a better understanding of what life is really like. Because I've spoken to people in the last 6 months who have thought, I'll go into teaching because, I won't have to work that many hours and, the holidays are good. And I'm thinking, you're going to get a hell of a shock when you go into it. And I think if people can go in with their eyes wide open, I think that would be much more helpful for them than going in thinking that, somehow this is going to be less stressful or less hours worked than the corporate life, because it isn't. They're on a par. I think in teaching you get more intensity at certain points of the year than you do in the corporate world, probably. And you, my word, by the end of July you need that break. Whereas I think in the corporate world you get you do get intensity, but probably not for such sustained periods of time. And it evens out over the course of the year, so you probably only need the breaks that you're getting. If people have been seduced by the idea of an easy life with long holidays, I think they're going to get a rude awakening. So I would always suggest that people do go in and spend some time in a school properly shadowing a teacher.
I think that's great advice. When I was at school, one of my friends on work experience, he went to his job and got paid 500 quid for the week of work experience. But I went to the school and spent it with them, their reception pupils. And so obviously that must have had a positive impact. But I remember feeling at the time, I wish I'd gone to the factory.
£500 in your back pocket would have been very nice. Yeah, but I suppose my overall advice is to those people is, you've got to do it. It's amazing. Do spend some time in a school first, but then if you think that you could do it, do it. Because as I said earlier to you, there's some really, really tough days, but I've loved every single day. I've never regretted, not for one second regretted the decision.
I mean, it's a privilege to do what we do.
Yeah.
To have the chance to impact on so many lives in a positive way. There are very few other professions where that is the case. I mean, it is tough. It feels like a worthwhile level of toughness, and that's probably
absolutely
dangerous in terms of people going too far and pushing themselves too far for the sake of the children in their class or the children in their school. But I don't know, it's a difficult balance to strike, but I think it's one that needs to be considered. And I think you're absolutely right, because when you're working through those intense periods, because you feel like you're working towards something, and you'll probably get to see some of the fruit of your labor, whether that be in July as your year one pupils are ready then to engage with year two and seem so much more grown up than they did when they came to you and stuff like that there. It's great to hear that you would recommend it to colleagues outside the profession. And I don't know if anyone's listening and they've got a colleague or a friend and they're thinking, perhaps a change is in order, teaching could be the one to go for.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I haven't regretted it for one second. I've loved every day. It is. There's a huge amount of responsibility. At least in the corporate world, all I could really do was lose money. Here, there's people you could lose if you haven't got your eyes on you on an outing or something. Or but also, you know, the whole education, that it's so important for them that you can have such an impact on them. The responsibility is much greater than in the corporate world.
That's fantastic. I mean, hopefully you'll come back and join us for future topics, in particular writing and your investigation into how we can instruct people. Because I mean, I know that's one of the writing's a topic that listeners find fascinating and really engage with and stuff. And so,
And
yeah,
it's
if you
something I found so difficult to teach as well, because I said we seem to, certainly in our training, and perhaps this was a weakness in the training, it seems to be that you model a bit and then you get people to write and write and write, and the more they write, the better they're going to get. But that hasn't, life hasn't panned out that way. I think you've got to be far more explicit about the different things you're teaching them. And that's why this writing book, it's really refreshing. It's a way I hadn't considered teaching writing. And I'm certainly going to be trying that out come September. We're
fantastic.
putting the plans together now. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So I think we've got after this episode one more episode before season six kicks off. So we've got essentially 2 months in which we're to sit down and see if we can find a date where we can chat writing and in particular being explicit. So, because I think it'll be fantastic. I mean, it's been a pleasure again. Always a pleasure to talk to you about education. And really, I think, yeah, fascinating to hear about your journey and how you find the transition. All I said to do is say thank you very much. Thank you for joining me.
Well, no, thank you for having me. And also thank you all the people in social media and research ed and those communities who don't mind helping a novice. It's been, I mean, the amount of help I've received has been ridiculous. So thank you, everybody.
Yeah, big time. I agree with that. You know, teachers are, you know, they were some of the kindest people in the world with their time and their effort.
Yeah.
So 100%. And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.